This is Functional Medicine Update for October 2011, Volume 31, Number 10. In this very special edition of FMU, we're bringing you a roundtable discussion which was recorded around an actual round table. It features several very successful practitioners of functional medicine discussing its use in clinical practice. The host for this discussion is Dr. Jeffrey Bland. Dr. Bland will follow up part one of this remarkable conversation with his own comments, including a recap of the panel. He will then go on to cover cholesterol in the diet, the management of sodium, he will discuss the defining of individual genetic makeup, and personalized lifestyle management. Part two of the roundtable discussion will be included in next month's issue of FMU. Now here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland with the October 2011 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
So we're here today in a very, very special environment to talk about lifestyle medicine, which has been kind of now moved up onto the marquee. Actually, there's even textbooks of medicine with the title Lifestyle Medicine. This is a text actually authored by Gary Egger and Stephen Rossner. I've met them. They're at medical school professors at Southern Cross University in Sydney, Australia. And this book outlines the manifesto of how lifestyle medicine could be integrated within the scope of traditional medicine, both primary care and in specialty medicine. And we're very fortunate, as I sit here today, to talk with leading experts from a variety of different backgrounds about their impression as to what does lifestyle medicine really mean, how does it interrelate with things like functional medicine or integrative medicine or good medicine in such a way as to deliver improved patient outcomes. So around the table, just to quickly introduce, we have the president of the Institute for Functional Medicine, David Jones. We have the person who has been a sports medicine expert for years and worked with athletes for a better part of 40 years and has a family practice clinic that's focused on preventive and functional related medicine, and that's Dr. Graham Reedy. We also have Dr. Jay Lombard, a psychiatrist neurologist from New York, who has a rich background in integrating all sorts of things from very traditional acute care, neuropsychiatric care into aspects of wellness-focused medicine. We have Dr. Jim Weiss, who is a leading expert and a growing clinical success story in integrating lifestyle medicine in his practice, which is a diverse practice with his partner in the area of general family medicine. And we have Dr. Ken Browning and his wife Sandy, who have integrated very successfully first-line therapy, lifestyle medicine in their practice in Riverside, California. And Dr. Christy Hughes, who is from Minnesota, who has been a leading proponent, advocate, formulator, and developer of lifestyle medicine programs and integrating that into her practices in Minnesota. So quite an esteemed panel of individuals that represent all sorts of different backgrounds. So, David, maybe I could start with you in that we go back 30 years in our experiences in this field. What does lifestyle medicine mean to you? Does it have a kind of a sense in your mind as to what it means?
Well, when you talk about lifestyle medicine, you put medicine on the back end of what in the past has been thought of as public health. Lifestyle factors in the public health, the epidemiology of chronic illnesses. And yet, when you look at the national guidelines, whether it's asthma, whether it's atherosclerotic heart disease, whether it's metabolic syndrome, all of them start with the admonition that you start with lifestyle interventions. And yet, those interventions are not taught to any of us that graduate from our medical schools. It reminds me of the article in JAMA where Dr. Holman actually apologized to the graduates of Stanford Medical School. He is an emeritus professor at Stanford Medical School. And he basically apologized that they had prepared their students for 20% of what they would see, which is acute medical disease, and that they should be preparing them for the chronic illnesses. And with chronic illnesses is the issue of lifestyle medicine. Now, that's beyond the public health issue of a diet, the four food groups, and et cetera, et cetera. Lifestyle medicine is about finding a personalized way of applying the science of nutrition, the science of exercise and movement, the science of sleep and restorative activities, the importance of relationships, and resiliency and stress. The science behind those is incredibly deep and robust, And how you apply that to the individual patient is what makes that a medicine and not a public health issue. So that's my response to the importance of lifestyle medicine. It's the next level of intervening with outcomes that are usually thought of the domain of the public health officer. It's the domain of the primary care physician and specialist in certain areas. And it's recognized. I mean, it's in every national guideline, and yet it's not taught. It's one of those things that everybody knows it's true, but there hasn't been the kind of education. And we could get into where's the money that makes that fact, but that isn't where we're going tonight. It's the money should be there, because every time they do a face-to-face test between lifestyle interventions versus drug and families of drugs interventions, lifestyle is much more powerful. And it's an absolute black mark on medicine that they deny the importance of that in the first step of intervention for the problems that we see 70 to 80% of the time in our offices.
That's a great segue. Thank you. Wonderful introduction. So let's switch to Dr. Reedy. I know you come very heavily from a sports and activity focus as it relates also to the construction of lifestyle medicine. Can you tell us a little bit about how you might weigh in on this topic?
I think that we're trained as professionals to tell everybody what a professional we are and to convince them how good we are. And there's a concept, I think, that I've especially learned more recently, that we as physicians have meta-speak. We have a lot of medical sounds, and it's been said that we're in medical training wherever there's some 13,000 new words that we learn. Those new words that we learn, we tend to try on people and consequently do not listen very well. So there's a form of medicine in which we talk. It's been said, we have a tell, ask, tell sort of thing. Tell me your problem, ask you one question which has one answer, and you tell them again what I think the answer is. And we have not been asked, tell, ask, which means how can I help you? How can I be a part of this? Not what you're scheduled for the schedule for, but how can I help you today? What is your immediate problem as you sit here in the waiting room, which might have changed in an hour that you came driving here? And so the ask, tell, ask is help us not have meta-speak. And the second part that comes to great mind to me is that communication, I deeply believe in, studied them in some 27 different countries that talked about how communication best occurs. And I like a phrase that says, everybody communicates, few connect. But then I like the fact that then the next part is how we not only connect, but how we collaborate as partners in this particular dilemma, as a third person, to make the dilemma a third part of what we're dealing with together as a team. And then we covenant. That means we covenant together to work on this journey, to make it worthy of our time, yours and mine, not just mine, not just ours. And that covenant is a critical piece. And then finally, the part that comes to me, I think, that's so important is that in the study around these countries, it said it's been found in over thousands of people that communication happens only 8% by words, 17% by tone inflections, and 75% by body language. And we're busy becoming a word system. And we're violating the very essence. I'm so glad to be hearing your thoughts on this, because all of you on this table, as far as I know, have that sense. And I feel like the biggest thing about integrating lifestyle is to shut up and listen and be quiet and not convince somebody how smart I am, but then talk about what excitement that I get in a get-to world, not a got-to world.
Beautiful. Thank you. So, Dr. Lombard, Jay, you got any from the subspecialty area that you represent, neurology, psychiatric area, often dealing with very critically emotionally ill patients?
Brain-based perspectives. By the way, I would want you to be my doctor, because something that I try to stress to residents in training is the key component of communication and listening with an unbiased and completely open way of hearing from a patient's perspective what actually they're suffering from, as opposed to us trying to contextualize it in our categorical as opposed to dimensional models of disease. And I think we're really at a very critical stage in medicine right now. For those of us that have been in academia recently, I think that we can all with dismay talk about what we see, at least what I see personally, is almost an autistic-like healthcare delivery system in which a physician almost completely dissociates from patient contact. Histories and review systems are given by ancillary health practitioners, not by physicians themselves. Forms are filled out with questionnaires. Lab tests are looked at, and MRI scans and radiological procedures without any real involvement of the interaction between a patient and physician. And I'll never forget something that our esteemed moderator here, Jeff Bland, had said many years ago, actually, which really struck me. I think it was in my first year of residency, which was that we've taken the sacredness out of medicine. And that sacredness of healing is about the relationship itself between physician and patient, and we can't neglect that. And I think where we as a society, not just in healthcare, but I think in all aspects of our current society, is that we think of problems as being one-dimensional in terms of how to fix them. And this is obviously a recipe for disaster. And lifestyle medicine, I think, offers us the ability to change a paradigm, to look more at a patient-centric way of intervening. And the last thing I want to say about, just since I am a neurologist and you know the brain is my one of my favorite organs, not the only one, but it's very often, if you think about change and how difficult it is for people to change behavior change occurs only in two ways, to avoid pain or to move towards pleasure. And if we hold out that basic principle about how our brain operates and use it to improve compliance or ways of engaging our patients in more healthy lifestyles, I think that principle can go a long way into understanding how to improve the delivery of such a complex network of healthcare.
Thanks. That was some real news to users, some very pithy gems. Jim, Dr. Weiss, you know, you made an interesting transition in your career from many years in subspecialty, very successful practice, into a little bit more diffuse area. Tell us a little bit about that transition.
Yes, so I'm a board-certified pulmonologist, board-certified in internal medicine as well. And for the first 16 years of my practice, I did an awful lot of ICU medicine, or as I call it, end-of-life medicine. And about 8 years ago, I made a transition because I wanted to prevent people needing what I was doing. And it's been a long journey. I've certainly learned a lot over the past 8 years. When I made the transition, the natural thing was to do primary internal medicine. And I found myself counseling people. I knew that lifestyle changes were the backbone, but I didn't know what it meant or what to do. And so I found myself writing in the plan, diet and exercise. And I began to question myself and think, well, what does that really mean? And I started investigating, which I guess has led me to this table today. So for me, lifestyle medicine is really about two things. It's about not only prevention, but I'm really struck on the data at how well you can treat these chronic diseases. I think that has to be of paramount importance to all practitioners, whether they're MDs or DOs or NPs, whatever. And the other thing for me, it's about healthy gene expression. And it's multimodality, the use of multimodality. Frankly, my interest is nutrition, but I certainly understand the concept of exercise, and I know there's MDs here in this room, but I'll say the word out loud, which I typically don't use, and that's meditation as well. So it's really multimodality for healthy gene expression.
I think you're in the right group to use the word meditation.
Yeah,
you're
in the
kindred spirits.
I don't think so. No, here I understand, but yeah. In other groups I hesitate to say that.
So Ken, you and Sandy have done just a masterful job of converting your clinic into a place, I would call it an oasis of lifestyle medicine. Tell us about that transition and what drove you or encouraged you to make that transition.
Well, like Jim, I was very traditional, board certified, in my case family practice, did a high-powered residency with the Air Force at Fort Gordon, Georgia, so I came out being able to do all these amazing, critical medical things. Did OB for a number of years, went through transition of private practice and groups and finally came back to private practice. And I woke up one morning and it dawned on me, and I look around this room and there's a lot of maturity in this room. And so I think it's the product of age, experience, journey. I'm not making a difference in anybody's life. I've seen enough colds and I've seen enough flus, enough UTIs. Well, what was I really doing with my passion? About this same time, we moved from a group back into a 1902 Heritage House, which is very welcoming and patients love it. And as Jeff says, it is an oasis in the medical world. And I had patients asking me, you know, doc, I take horse chestnut, or I take glucosamine for my knees so I can play golf. I take this, I take that. How does that mix with my medication? And I had to be honest with them, I had no clue. But I heard this so often that I realized I needed to find out. So it was just a stroke of luck that I called somebody who put me in touch with somebody who put me in touch with somebody. And we spent months courting, as I like to call it, because this was new language. This was a whole new world for me. I went through a couple of lifestyle educators. I was banking on them to hold me by the hand and lead me by the way, and one day at my doorstep was Chris Gatke, who is the lifestyle educator extraordinaire in the world. And we'd sit around in the mornings. I like to say I'd have a cup of coffee and he wouldn't, because he's the purist. And we would solve all the problems in the world. And you know what I'm talking about. It's how do we do this and how do we do that. And I often say that I was so stupid I didn't know what I didn't know. And that I shouldn't be able to do what we started to do. And all we started to do was do lifestyle medicine. Started doing FLT before it was FLT. And it's been a great journey.
Sandy, how about you? You've shared this journey. You've been a vocal spokesperson working through the patients. Has it been a transition, as Ken described it, for you?
Well, certainly. You know, the transitioning was tricky. But I think what really powered it was realizing that we were helping our patients, his patients, by giving them really simple, usable tools. And then having the results they were looking for. You were talking about avoiding pain and working towards pleasure. Well, you know, a lot of people were motivated by the conditions that brought them in and were actually being vocal about wanting something other than another prescription, and were given some things that they could pretty easily implement starting day one. And that kind of just set on itself.
And did you find that from your experience that word of mouth became a kind of a transition force to change your practice? As people had success, they went and talked to other people, and suddenly you started getting the Dr. Browning reputation of where to go?
Well, at first it was like pulling teeth, because, mind you, this was 8 years ago, and the public was not aware, as it is today, that there are alternatives out there to just getting a slew full of prescriptions. I was also very shy when I first started. My confidence level was not high. Nowadays, I'm accused of being almost Halcyon, great house. Because I will tell people, I'll just get in their face. I mean, you read their personality and such, but I will get into their face and say, this is what you need to do. Now, I'll write your prescription for 10 prescriptions if that's what you want. But in this office, we don't do that. You know, we're going to teach you how to eat. We're going to teach you how to eat a modified Mediterranean diet and how to do it five times a day, and you're going to get control back of your life. How does that sound? And they go. And so now, when I always ask my new patients, how did you find me? So-and-so sent me, or I heard about you. So that makes the journey with them much easier, because I'm not having to start from square one.
Yep. So, Christy, this is a great segue to you, because a lot of what we're talking about was pioneered by you and Lyra in the form of FLT. Tell us about your journey on this whole revelational process.
Well, it's definitely been a process. It's no question, and a journey, a pleasurable journey. As someone already commented, we were doing lifestyle medicine before it was called lifestyle medicine, and I think that's a really interesting review when you look back over this last decade. And if I were going to summarize lifestyle medicine in one most important term, I would use the words empowerment, empowerment for the patient, that it's a joy to be able to hand that locus of control back over to the patient with knowledge. And it's an honor to be in relationship with a patient. And I would state that's probably the second most important thing that's taking place in lifestyle medicine is everything is about relationship. It's relationship to self. It's relationship to your provider, your coach, your doctor. It's about your relationship to food, your relationship to want to move your body or not move your body. And so I would say empowering the patient, really encouraging them to come full circle. And it, in a non-demeaning way, to me it is so comparable to managing the transition of bringing a little person from 2 until 5 or 6, because you have to teach skill sets. You have to teach ways in which that person will come to that discovery on their own, and they don't realize that it was a guide. You guided them to realize, I want to eat more legumes in my diet. I need more color in my plate. I need to get up, and I need to move my body because it's the right thing for me. So to really bring yourself to the other side of the table and get out of the advice giving and the empowerment position, I think that's probably the greatest privilege of doing lifestyle medicine. And I had the absolute joy of getting to come to medicine through a naturopathic medical background training, and then I found functional medicine immediately right outside of my naturopathic training. And so to me, this is the only language I know. You know, in a sense, I grew up inside of this mindset, and for me it's a bigger challenge to step outside and try to look at the challenges, because I think lifestyle medicine is common sense. It's so much common sense. It's what the patient's asking for, and intuitively on so many levels, you just need to give them permission to go there.
Thanks. By the way, we've just had join us Dr. Mark McIntosh. Mark, thanks so much for being here all the way from Florida. Mark is University of Florida, one of our co-investigators, and just was one of the lead authors in a big multi-center trial that we were involved in. Wonderful paper. Thanks, Mark, and thank you for being here. And we're just talking about what each individual thinks in their mind lifestyle medicine means to them.
Pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you here. Thank you. Coming from emergency medicine, that seems like almost 180 degrees away from lifestyle medicine, but yet you've done some extraordinary things in kind of segueing these concepts into your practice and into your mindset. How did that occur?
Well, I'm still on the journey, but you know, really, it's spending many nights in the emergency department. You realize that we're doing a tremendous job with acute care medicine, but we realize that probably 75% to 80% of the patients that I would see at night, they were there because of poor lifestyle choices. So it felt like I was at the bottom of the cliff picking up the pieces. And if I was just able to build a fence at the top of that cliff, then we could perhaps have true impact and prevent a lot of the things that I was specifically seeing. So therefore, I really began to delve into the concept, well, how do we deal with chronic disease? And Dr. Jones, as well as yourself, I had the opportunity to be introduced to the concept of lifestyle medicine. And the way I would really define it is it's really whole person medicine or patient-centered medicine. The type of medicine which I was so used to doing was really physician-centered medicine. And definitely I reiterate the point, we are empowering the patient. So therefore, I really, at that point, wanted to ask the question, well, how can I have an impact within a university setting, the training of physicians who are our residents, and also specifically the staff and physician population. So therefore I moved into corporate wellness as well. Still doing emergency medicine, I can't leave that love, but I realized that corporate wellness, this is where we spend 40 hours a week. You know, these are where our employees are and our patients. Quite often they become our patients. And I realized that we can intervene in their lives, really how they think, how they work, how they eat, how they move or exercise. And it really comes down to the fact that lifestyle medicine, the physiology is really complex, but really the underlying causes of so much of the chronic disease has so many interacting nodes. And it's really looking at how our environment, our work environment, how the air we breathe, the food we eat, really washes over our genes and determines whether we have health or whether we do not. And I think lifestyle medicine is really the tool which we can use to change behavior and even at the genetic level, really have a phenotypic response in a very healthy way. And just the privilege of participating in the multi-center trial just showed me this is really possible. And it's through behavior, through walking into that room with real intention, interacting with those patients and determining who they are as a whole person.
Wow, I tell you, this round robin just once around the table is enough food to feed you intellectually and emotionally for quite a while. So a lot of power words, right, were discussed. Relationships, empowerment, intention, the collaborate, connection, covenant, how we might work on developing this high-level communication, being good listeners, active listening, another very powerful concept. Jay's concept of people make decisions on the basis of either avoiding pain or moving to pleasure, and how do you navigate through that matrix to use the nervous system as your guidance for compliance and adherence. And then this whole concept of recognizing that late-stage disease starts off with altered function. So using the lens to focus on the right things, because if we just wait for pathophysiology, we may have missed all sorts of precedents that could have been guides for us earlier. So with that, now, David, let me turn to you as one of the longstanding founders and developers of the functional medicine concept. How would you see a differentiation, if at all, between what we call lifestyle medicine and functional medicine? Where do they connect or overlap?
Well, I think the participants at this table would probably say the same thing. But if you go to the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, you talk to Colin Campbell, for instance, lifestyle medicine has a certain degree of one size fits all, that there's certain common foods that we should be eating, we should do a modified Mediterranean diet is a very common thought, certain one size fits all in terms of so much exercise each day. And my experience was that I got into this early on because it was pretty obvious that it was lifestyle. The day-to-day, minute-to-minute choices of my patients were impacting them in such a way that they ended up with a diagnosis that by standard of care, I needed to put them on drugs, and I'm sitting at my desk at the end of the day wondering, can I keep doing this? Because I was seeing the side effects from drugs and wondering if I shouldn't be calling them and saying the best thing for your health would be to stay away from me. I mean, that literally happened. That's when I went searching, and that's when we started working together, and that was almost 40 years ago. The personalization of lifestyle medicine is the next step, and that's knowing what the difference is, the core diet, say the Mediterranean diet, but what if the person has, metabolic problems versus toxicity problems versus endocrine problems versus, and the list goes on. How do you create an architecture that can take these concepts of lifestyle and physiology and marry them to the patient in such a way that it has a very specific and focused application? And that's why some of the people in lifestyle medicine say, well, you know, this functional medicine stuff is just too complex. Well, I'm sorry. If you do lifestyle medicine, you'll get 60 to 70% of people better, because the marketing to keep them imprisoned in very bad habits is very effective. So if you can get them out of those habits of eating the wrong way, of sitting on the couch and watching football games and being more interested in their rotisserie group versus taking care of themselves, you'll get 60, 70% of those people better. But it's that other group that, as physicians, it's a very focused issue of how do you apply these powerful tools. So I know from the specific kind of genetic testing, from questionnaires, from getting to know the patient, that they need something tweaked in their relationships, in their stress, in their diet. That's a specific functional application that's very personalized and takes it to another level. I deal with almost all of my patients are that 30%, because they come in, they're already on some kind of diet that they have read is good for them, and they're already exercising, and they're already doing the basic issues of looking at their lifestyle. But how do you focus that so it affects them and that it's different than the same dog and pony show you do with everybody else? I mean, one of the big issues in lifestyle medicine is, how is this different than public health?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's different than public health if you have an architecture, a thinking methodology for making it specific to their needs. If you don't, you're doing lifestyle public health measures. So in my mind, lifestyle medicine, functional medicine are the same thing. But in the minds of people that I talk to that are experts in the area of lifestyle medicine, we do something different because I spend time doing things that they think are too specific, too complex. I make it too hard. Well, complex problems require complex thinking. I mean, you just can't do one size fits all. And so I think in terms of the actuality of lifestyle medicine versus functional medicine, our particular approach takes it to that next level. Yes, all of those measures that we're talking about in terms of standard lifestyle medicine teachings, those are part of the formula and the relationship. But what emerges in my clinic when you bring that specificity to that patient, and then you let them choose because you understand the different doorways they can walk through, that's looking at their specific functional issues. So that's the way I see it, and I see when I talk to practitioners that have a different kind of approach. What we're teaching is complex, but the human organism is complex.
Good, thank you. So complex is a good place to segue to Dr. Reedy, who has 50 patients waiting in his waiting room that he's going to see over the course of the day. Having been in that environment, I can feel the sense of complexity that must work through his nervous system. So, Graham, from your experience, what are the barriers that you've encountered in introducing these concepts successfully in a general practice?
I have the advantage of some of you that the only patients getting off us is if they exercise and hurt themselves exercising. So that calms the herd. In the Northwest, that means that if the milk's not milking, then I'm sorry, love your dog. The cow's not there anymore. So we've culled the herd in terms of people that want to be well, people that already want to be there. Then from that particular group, we build on asking a set of questions. And I think there's a great quote that's said to us in medical school by wise people that says, when all else fails, ask the patient. And so I will oftentimes say, you came in, we had you scheduled for this and this and this. What would you say of the things that you're most concerned about is the biggest concern? What is that? And then to teach my staff, because the staff is a key person. They do the front, they do the check-in, they've got the computer, they've got the thing. They come in, that's all their biggest issues. I will oftentimes work with the staff by saying, this is a lifestyle program. Listen to the words not said. Listen to the phrases that they feel. Listen to what it is that you think they want to say, but are afraid to say. And what you'll do is, they may not tell you, but you'll open the door while they'll tell me. And that way they'll do it better. And then I have a staff person with me, because we're all computerized records, in the room the entire time. So that I say, this is the things that seem to me, you're saying to me that you want most to do. Is that correct? And I love one statement I heard not long ago that said, the average physician time the patient sat down in front of by the physician before the doctor interrupts is 17 seconds. And in that has been shown by studies that if you'll merely listen for 2 minutes, that 75% of what the visit is about will be told to you. And about 25 to 50% of the solution will come from them, not me. And in that regard, it's as though if I then feel that they're making headway, I validate them. And when they walk out, they feel they've been heard. But more than that, they feel valued as a person, especially if that waiting room environment is really happening. Not quite that many, but if it does happen, then they feel like they're stressed as much as me. And so there's a reason to put them there. You put the patients on eye level. I never sit them on exam table, bench here. That's for lifestyle. The computer's here, I'm here, they're here. Never, ever anything between us. I'm touching all day, all the time. my nurse practitioner just went and said, I've never seen anybody that is so busy somewhere, not doing anything, but examining, doing their things. Because what I'm trying to do is to find a way. And to me, you can't open the door to lifestyle change unless you find a connection. And then Fonny would say, of all the things you've said to me, I want you to go home, and these are the three things I heard. You know, I'm not really sure that's what your three things must are. So what I'd like you to do is go home. I'd like you to write them out, and you bring them back. And then I may, in some situations, do what this fellow here does, and that is, I, depending on the openness of the person, sit on the little bench myself and sit them on my chair and say, so, I have this problem. What are your top three solutions? And by giving a paradigm shift, I give them the responsibility of being equally as smart as me. I tell them, you're just as smart as me. I just learned 13,000 words you haven't heard of before. And the point is, that doesn't make me smart. It just makes me stuck. I'm narrow. I'm very, very narrow. And so I want to learn what it is that you think will help me. So I involve them. And then oftentimes I use a lot of journaling and have them journal with me.
Yeah, I really noticed that in your practice. People that are there, no matter the age, be it high school athletes or weekend warriors or aspirants in middle age, they all have a common bond of being on this journey with you and feeling as a participant, but with a good guide. It's not like a journey that you're wandering off with a scout that you don't know, that they have no cartography. So there's a guidance principle that goes on there that's very solid, right? So it ties itself to something that's both sacred and substantial. So I think that's an interesting way of thinking about lifestyle medicine. And by the way, that concept of the 17 seconds to make a snap decision, that comes from the book How Doctors Think, which was written by the Harvard Medical School professor. It talks about the linear Cartesian Bacon-esque way that we train people to think, and we train out of them reductive reasoning, and we train into them rote reasoning and memorization. So I think that that kind of breaks the pattern of lifestyle medicine, which is, as has been said by all of you, more of a web than a single bullet. It's more of a interconnected web than a single explanation. So, Jay, you've been in the medical school teaching environment, you've been in the clinical trauma unit, you've been in private practice, you've been an educator, you've been an author, you've been a scholar, you've been a spiritual journey. How does all of this interesting mosaic and texture weave itself into the relationships that you have with your patient? I would imagine it's very different than a traditional neurologist or psychiatrist.
It's hard to follow Graham, because I think what Graham says is quite a very powerful role model for physicians to follow. And I think that everybody here shares this concept about the importance of relationship in healing. And I know that when I'm very effective as a healer, it's because I'm completely present in that interaction that's occurring, even if it's only 2 minutes, that requires us to step out of ourselves and into the perception of who that person is that's coming to see us who's ill. And again, I love the analogy you gave about sort of changing roles and having the patient themselves be the problem solver. I think it's a brilliant technique to engage patients in. I think that one of the things I think that we all have to understand, and this is again maybe a brain-centric approach, but you have to understand that illness in many ways reflects not just a physical disorder, but an existentialist or spiritual disorder as well, and that all illness can be seen as both a reflection of both a physical disorder and also an emotional or mental disorder. And unless we address that in our toolbox, if you will, to understand what are the driving forces that create illness based upon a person's perception of themselves, their relationship with themselves, relationship that they have with their spouse, their children, with their community, those are really key elements of a healing process that we've neglected to really discuss, you know, current Western paradigms of medicine. Those sometimes are the most important element. And sometimes it's just really a matter of a patient being heard for the first time. I can't tell you how many times someone will just break down and start crying just because the first time they actually were ever listened to. It's not rocket science. There's a famous quote from, I think, Cecil's textbook of medicine, that the secret to care for patients is to care for patients. You know, it's not that complicated, but we forget the basics. I think one of the things that I'm sort of, Christy, I'm sort of the opposite of you. I sort of grew up outside of functional medicine, whatever words you want to put on it. And I think that if we look at some of the obstacles that I see from a sociological perspective in terms of adoption of some of the common sense things that we're talking about here, some of them are really economical. And we have to really understand that there are cost barriers that are very real. We've created a medicine which is really accessible only to people who can afford it. And for this to be a transformational type of medicine for society, we have to find ways of making it more economically scaled to all comers, not just people who are able to pay out of pocket for it. And that's something I think that we should be cognizant of.
Some really good pearls there. And that's a good segue to Dr. Weiss. Jim, as you made this transition from pulmonology over into a more health promotion, wellness-based practice, how did you handle the economics? How do you deal with the reimbursement to services issue? Is it something that you're still modeling? Is there an approach that you've seen that starts to make that make sense?
Well, I'm blessed to have the second best lifestyle educator. And, you know, insurance reimburses for my time and also reimburses for my lifestyle educator's time, assuming you follow the proper prescription. And I want to tag on something that David said. It's absolutely true that it has to be personalized. I haven't been in it for, I haven't been doing this for 40 years. I've been doing it less than 8. And my lifestyle educator is a different personality. So there are certain patients who connect with me and I work with them. And I try and give them the time that they need. I have a practice style that's really designed for that, which is a benefit. And I listen to those patients. There are other patients who connect better with Stephanie, frankly. And initially, I'm catching up to her now, but initially she frankly had a better understanding of, you know, the supplements, etc. I mean, we are talking about a paradigm shift in medicine. I'm a classically trained physician who had no clue, and, you know, it takes time to learn. And so in my office, we try and keep it as low cost for the patients as possible. The one stumbling block is the cost of the medical food or the supplements. But I have had very little pushback because my experience, you know, I'm in Southern California, this is what the population there wants. And they don't have to be super wealthy to be willing to reach into their pocket to pay for the medical food or to pay for the fish oil, etc. The fact that they know, A, they're going to be healthier, which is absolutely spiritual and existential, and potentially have their, I don't remember I heard it, the term, but potentially have their health span approximate their lifespan. That's very important. That's what people want, and it's a question of priority. There are some people who won't reach into their pocket for it, and it makes it harder to help them. But I have not had a problem getting people to pay for it. Granted, I'm in an affluent area of the country. I don't know what it would be like in other places.
Yeah, so let's ask you the same question, because I know in Riverside County, you probably have a very mixed socioeconomic population of patients from my experience in Riverside. So you probably have a wide array of differing abilities to have discretionary income available. So how is that influenced, or how does it influence, if at all, how you deliver the program?
Well, Riverside is a very blue-collar area, Riverside, San Bernardino, that whole area. I'm still trying to figure this out. My practice is still heavy laden with managed care, and we all know the joke or the one-liner that you have 5 minutes to spend with a patient. But every patient that I see, even if it's mom brings in Joey with an earache, I throw something out there about wellness. I throw something out there about lifestyle medicine, about how we're different. They walk into the office and one of the first things they see is our natural pharmacy. So that that spurs questions. I search for ways to open dialogue with patients, whatever that may be. Typically, I'll throw off these tidbits on a 5 or 7 minute visit, whatever it may be, and then finally, a hook is set. And that 7 minute visit becomes 20 minutes or a half hour, right? And then you're behind. But it gets my passion going because I just so much love that aspect of medicine, because finally we can give people tools to prevent or even get their lives back so that they can have a great life. They can have a healthy life. They can have an abundant life. What we do with our HMO patients, we have probably 30% are HMO. I work with them when I can, and I send them up to see a lifestyle educator for their copay. Now, business-wise, that's not real sound. But if it's about getting people well, then that's what you do. With the hope that they will go out and tell their friends and tell their family, and more people will come, and more people will come. My experience with the PPOs and Medicare is, if you bill it correctly, or hopefully what you believe is correctly, in the spirit of correctness, they pay okay. They pay okay. So for the physicians out there that are wondering, can I make a living doing this? Yes, you can. Yes, you can. But you have to get creative. You just have to just pay more attention to what's going on with your people. Graham, I loved what you said. I've heard it before, but I haven't heard it for a long time. I appreciate what you said. Just shutting up and listen. I mean, we're all kind of designed as, especially, the male part of us, is what? We're fixers. Tell me what's wrong, and I'll fix it. Well, that's some things, that, of course, that's real. Emergency room medicine, that'd be perfect. Critical medicine, that'd be perfect. But in the folks that just come into our office, they may not even know what's wrong with them until they can get it out, voice it. So thank you for that.
And Ken, you know, we've had the privilege, many of us, to see some of the videos of your patients. There's several that have just struck me deeply. They're kind of like mental images etched on the inside of my neurons that when I get tired and wonder what I'm doing, I remind myself of these experiences. And I'm reminded of the one of many of the high school teacher that you had who was transformed. And I think at the end, he looked at the camera and he said, I thank Dr. Browning and Chris, my lifestyle educator, for saving my life. Those are, how do you value these? How do you turn on the investment on those kinds of comments? So they're very, very powerful. I really appreciate you and your patient sharing those things, because they're the most powerful learning tools when we see these personal transformations occur.
And it is so different than sitting at your desk looking at the list and reviewing the number of side effects from the medicines that you've given. Because the difference in my life from sitting at the desk and then saying, I either got to quit this profession or I got to go out and find different answers because I can't live with this. And now what happens when you engage and something emerges from that context of healing that is bigger than you instead of being smaller than you?
In our office, we call it, we do the happy dance.
Yeah.
That's good. That's a good visual metaphor. So, Christy, tell me, a lot of these principles we're talking about are the tradition of natural medicine, of naturopathic medicine, so maybe that's why it's so deeply in your DNA. But I'm sure you get questions, because you're educating all sorts of different disciplines, about how can you be so presumptuous to tell people that are believing in pharmacology as solutions to these issues that lifestyle medicine would be a successful, different approach. So how have you managed through that?
First, do no harm. I think it's really the oath that we've taken. And what is so powerful in lifestyle medicine, which you experience within the first couple months of truly doing it and living it, and you see it in patient care and patient results, is often the most powerful thing is helping the patient identify or flag their obstacles in their healing path. So what is it that's holding them back from healing? Just that identification alone. Is it your job? Is it where you live? Is it your home? Oh, you've got lead in your well water. You didn't know. So the first step for me in lifestyle medicine is identify those triggering events. You know, if we're going to talk about it in a functional medicine model, it's triggers and triggering events in your ATM model. What's triggering the disease or trigger the episode? So with lifestyle medicine, number one, remove the trigger, remove the obstacle. And then number two, you go to the foundations of health. You really open up the storyline and say, well, what else is holding them back from their healing as it relates to their food choices, their movement, their sleep, their resilience, their relationships, and their social network. And so you live it in practice. You see it transform your family's lives, your patients' lives. You see this, as Dr. McIntosh spoke to, you know, seeing it in a large group experience as well. And you become a believer in that sense. So through great confidence, through clinical experience, through, I think, one of the most important aspects of the journey for the clinician who is learning lifestyle medicine is to learn discernment in knowing which program or direction to place the patient. You know, if I were going to take a patient who presented with minimal intra-abdominal or visceral fat, who was really holding weight in other areas of the body or lower, below the waistline, who struggled with weight loss for 20, 30 years, who didn't have elevated triglyceride levels, and who wasn't suffering with blood pressure concerns, and they walked in the door and they needed lifestyle transformation, I would have to give them a program that would be more targeted and more designed to deal with the underlying causes of their disease. So if we're going to come back to the roadmap, for me, the map is a functional medicine map that lifestyle medicine lives and exists within. Remove the obstacles. Identify your antecedents, triggers, and mediators. Remove the obstacles to healing. Next, go to the foundations of health. Deal with the lifestyle medicine concerns. Again, transform the diet. Help move them through behavioral modification. And then just step back and watch it happen. And I like to just even give it 2 weeks, 2 weeks, 4 weeks. In 8 weeks, miracles will happen. And at that point, I want to know what's left. And when I can see which symptoms are left or what are the areas or concerns that aren't clearing or moving in the right direction, well, then I'm going to take a more advanced therapeutic intervention route and apply the systems biology approach to functional medicine. So for me, it is so remarkable. It's a remarkable experience to have a patient come in, sit down across the desk from you or next to you and just sob for joy, which is a very different experience than them sobbing from the pain and thanking you profusely. Our practice is a 100%, 95% referral at this point, and I'm either the patient's first choice or they've been through 10 other providers. And so I end up where I happen to live. I chose to go back to the Midwest because there weren't other providers doing this, so I end up with the patients from the functional medicine, the integrative practitioners, who they don't know where to go next. And I go right back to the basics. What are the triggers? Remove the obstacles. Transform the foundations to health and wellness. And then let's dive into the other areas of pathology. Then we'll look at our assimilation and our GI concerns, or we'll deal with detox, or we'll move into the endocrine system. But there's so much power in just giving the body the chance to heal.
I'm reminded of the beautiful statement you made, and really it reminded me of conversations that we've all had or listened to with Mark Hyman, who when he was working at Canyon Ranch always would introduce himself as a resort doc, right? The doctor of last resort at Canyon Ranch, because he was the guy that was providing the different kind of medical services than the traditional pharmacology. So Mark, you made a comment which I want to follow back up with, because I think it's a very, very interesting comment, that you learned a lot by participating in this multi-centered clinical trial, that your site was one of the three sites on a metabolic syndrome intervention trial. I'd love to know, as you had a chance to kind of get away from it a little bit and look back, what did you learn? Other than the data, what was the most impactful for you as a learning experience?
Probably the major thing that I've learned is that we truly do have a sick care system and not a health care system. By doing the project, most of the participants, most of the people that we enrolled in the study actually were employees or staff. Actually, by implementing the therapeutic lifestyle changes and using the nutraceuticals, we truly had major successes on the campus, and you could see those people, their lives transformed. And that was extremely powerful to our administration, that, you know, we needed to do something different. So that actually, now I'm taking it more to the macro level, because what happens now is I have a sick system, not exactly a sick patient. So I'm using every opportunity that I can, using the functional medicine model to essentially address the whole system. So from the experience in the clinical trial, now we have moved into developing a whole corporate wellness program. We did not have corporate wellness at our organization, and we are implementing a lot. Now, you know, it is hard to do corporate wellness on a personalized level, but a lot of the principles that we are using, how to eat well, think well, breathe well, move well, all of those aspects are really coming from this model. So we started corporate wellness. Secondly, within the past year, we developed a physician-directed weight management program. Now, some of those patients will potentially entertain bariatric surgery, but bariatric surgery is just a tool. And if you don't learn lifestyle changes, you will not have the success. And obviously, our hopes is many of those patients will not have to entertain a bariatric surgery. They'll see the lifestyle changes that will. And we also started a palliative care program, you know, started in the past year. Palliative care, I mean, who is this? But these are the patients who are suffering chronic disease, whether they're being cured or not cured. Once again, the model can be the whole person medicine can be applied. So out of the study, we've developed a corporate wellness program, physician-directed weight management program, and palliative care within the past 2 years. And so it's looking at the macro more than the micro. So we're making some steps, and that's how I think we're going to change medicine in the future. We'll see the successes from that standpoint. The administration will see it. It'll shift down, hopefully, to our physicians and our residents as well. Different approach rather than one patient at a time, but you know, we can see it's taking place.
Very inspiring. Thank you. That's a wonderful collateral benefit from being engaged in a clinical trial. Fantastic. I wish all trials would end up with that kind of revelation in the participants.
This roundtable discussion will continue on next month's edition of Functional Medicine Update. Now, from somewhere else on the globe, here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland.
This roundtable on lifestyle medicine was truly one of the most remarkable experiences that I've had the privilege of participating in over the last several years. What an amazing group of clinicians. I think you could tell from the tones of their voices, the seriousness, the passion, the level of integrity that they brought to this discussion, how important this area really is as an emerging theme in healthcare and primary delivery of high-quality medicine. One of the things that struck me throughout the course of this discussion with these experts, these key opinion leaders, was how their different backgrounds and their different experiences and training ultimately led them to a very, very similar path of convergence in how they see the go-forward activities of their daily lives in medicine. So as we went around and looked at the various individuals from the academic background of a neurology, psychiatry background of a Jay Lombard, who's both been in hospital-based medicine and in clinical practice, who talks about kind of the end of the spectrum of people with neuropsychiatric difficulties, but where they come from, kind of the front edge, and how lifestyle medicine can play a role in their lives by connecting them more effectively to positive outcomes, to moving to what Jim Weiss talked about from the perspective of someone who is a pulmonologist in specialty medicine who then made this transition into this new field of lifestyle medicine with some trepidation, but found that it was substantive and that when he started to include this in his practice, that patients had remarkable improvements that he wasn't seeing from the previous traditional approach using and trained, and ultimately led him to transition his whole practice into this lifestyle medicine approach. Into then a discussion with Christy Hughes, who has been such a leader in the field of education from a naturopathic medical perspective and history, and how it connects into her background and her training and offers patients a way that they can integrate these concepts into their own daily living. It's not just treatment choices that they don't understand that are written as an illegible script that they take to the pharmacist. They don't even understand what the molecules in that prescription really do and how they might work. But here it's really engaging the person in a process that they own. It's their life. It's their lifestyle. And they win the successes by their own commitment to the program, and in so doing have this value-added benefit beyond the therapy itself of re-engaging themselves with the sense of control, the locus of control that Albert Bandura talks about in Self-Efficacy. And then into this incredible discussion with Graham Reedy, a sports medicine specialist, ex-team physician for the Oakland Raiders, been in private practice now for 40 years, dealing with athletes of all ages, weekend warriors up to high school athletes, and how that connects into something that they understand and see benefit of, starting with an athletic injury, but then getting into the broader spectrum of how lifestyle manages not only injury prevention and management, but also general health considerations as an individual grows older. These are all really very, very dramatic examples, I think, of the unique spreading effect of this lifestyle medicine concept, because it's more than just a therapy in and of itself. It is a connection, as Jay Lombard talks about when he talks about behavioral psychiatry or behavioral neurology. It relates a lot to how we see these things all connecting together so that the patient becomes the focal point of their own program. They own it. It lives with them every breath of life. This is actually exactly what was talked about in Dr. Eger's book, Lifestyle Medicine, which you recall we had the privilege of interviewing him on Functional Medicine Update from his academic position at Southern Cross University in Sydney, Australia, last year. And Dr. Eger was talking about the important role that lifestyle medicine has in the engagement, in the nature of setting the environment between the patient and the practitioner, so that the patient becomes part of their own treatment. They become part of the solution to their own problem, that in the end, they are the ones that own their lives. They're the ones in which they're living in that body. And so by using the resources of the practitioner as a high-level kind of coach in some ways, health coach, and then the patient engaged in that process as the owner of the program, it's inspiring and enlightening to both the patient and obviously the practitioner. It establishes a different context. And in fact, it's very interesting when you talk about the healing encounter. You go into the offices of these kinds of docs that have been the part of this roundtable, and what you'll find in their waiting room is a very different kind of feeling than you'll find in the waiting room of docs that are principally focused on pill for an ill. The patients are more empowered. They're more proactive. There's a general positive energy in the waiting room. These patients are generally not down and out. They're up and out type patients, and they generally cluster together in groups of positive affirmation. So it's enlightening to the staff. It's uplifting. It creates a sense of, I think we would say, the improving of function rather than the concept of being caught in a disease for which a person has no explanation or no understanding or might think they're just genetically predisposed to get it and that was just the way it was. So I think that these conceptual frameworks that you hear these masters talking about really defines the concept of a lifestyle medicine beyond that just of the intervention program in and of itself, the contextual nature of healing. Now, going on beyond that, there's another phase in this discussion that I think is very important, and I think it's one of the key takeaways that you picked up out of this roundtable, and that's the difference between a public health program that's associated with lifestyle medicine and a program that we would call personalized to the individual. This personalized program is really what differentiates, I think, a treatment program for the person, patient-centered medicine, versus a general approach for health improvement in the public at large. So let's differentiate, if we can. Now, a couple of notable examples that have been in the discussion for some time would be cholesterol and salt. So we have this concept that people should be on low cholesterol diets. That's a public health message. So limit your dietary cholesterol intake has been a public health message. Yet it's well recognized, and when you actually look at the response that the general public has to cholesterol in the diet, for the majority of the population, that would be 80 to 90% of the population, the amount of cholesterol in their diet coming in as cholesterol is a small an almost insignificant contributor to the amount of cholesterol in their blood. The amount of cholesterol in their blood is really a consequence principally of de novo cholesterol biosynthesis at the liver and intestinal levels by other factors that stimulate cholesterol synthesis other than direct cholesterol ingestion. Now, with that as a concept, you would say, well, but the public health message says that we should be reducing cholesterol in all people's diets. So where does that come from if only a small percentage of the population are individuals that would really dramatically benefit from reducing their dietary cholesterol? Well, here's where you go from a public health message, which might be generally considered good, to a personal health message, which is how do you change that individual's diet to make the maximum benefit in their health outcome? So for that individual who is not an individual for whom cholesterol in their diet is a major contributor to their blood cholesterol, you would want to focus on the other personalized principles in their lifestyle that contributed to the de novo cholesterol biosynthesis and put less emphasis on reducing foods that are rich in cholesterol. So that would be an example of a difference between a public health message and a personalized lifestyle message. Let me use another example of sodium, salt. We recognize that sodium is a contributor to hypertension, and hypertension is pandemic in our Western population and is a certain risk factor to cerebral vascular disease and cardiovascular disease and associated with diabetes. So we would say, oh, well, then salt, because it's associated with increased blood pressure and blood pressure has these deleterious effects on health, we should be reducing salt. Yet, if we look again at the genetics of sodium sensitivity, we find that something like 10 or 15% of the population have these genetic uniquenesses that make them very sodium sensitive, meaning they have a significant sensitivity to sodium relative to the vascular reactivity of their endothelium and controlling blood pressure. For the majority of individuals, modest ranges of salt intake have reasonably insignificant influences on their blood pressure. There are other variables that are more important in controlling blood pressure. So if we were to use a public health message saying everybody should be on a salt-restricted diet, it may have a significant benefit only for those individuals who have this unique characteristic of sodium sensitivity. And so one would want to focus their energies in doing appropriate personalized lifestyle medicine on asking the question, is that person a sodium-sensitive individual? If so, then managing sodium should be done very assiduously and carefully. If they're not a sodium-sensitive person and they have a blood pressure problem, you would probably want to direct your attention and focus on a variable series of other things, exercise, stress management, maybe magnesium in the diet, essential fatty acids, including omega-3 fatty acids, potassium levels, dietary fiber. I mean, there's a whole range of other things that we would probably put more emphasis on in managing a blood pressure in those individuals who are not sodium sensitive than just saying putting them on a salt-restricted diet. Now, the reason I'm going into these details is to try to differentiate what the panel was really speaking to, the difference between a public health message, and I think David Jones in his comments as part of the panel did a brilliant job of discussing how one differentiates between a public health-directed health promotion program and a functionally focused personal lifestyle program. And I think this is where functional medicine really does interface with lifestyle medicine. It's probably the difference between the Egger book on lifestyle medicine and the Institute for Functional Medicine textbook of functional medicine, which really starts getting more patient-centered, more individually focused to personalization. And I think David Jones did an eloquent job in the panel discussion in really differentiating and juxtaposing those two models. When I look at this from a functional medicine perspective, I recognize that the origin of the concept of functional medicine that underlies the Institute of Functional Medicine's training and teaching programs was really a model that was built out of the recognition of biochemical individuality, genetotrophic disease of Roger Williams, of the Archibald Garrod concepts of inborn uniquenesses of metabolism, of the Linus Pauling concept of molecular or orthomolecular medicine. Those conceptual frameworks are different than a public health message because they're much more dealing with the uniqueness of the individual at a functional level. Now, you tie that together with what we're learning in the present age of molecular and cellular biology, what I would call the age of genomics. This could be really the age of omics. We have genomics, proteomics, metabolomics, lipomics, the kinomics, phenomics, all these various omic derivatives really come out of the conceptualization of understanding the difference between individuals at the genetic, cellular, tissue, and organ-specific level, and how to personalize that. That, to me, is the frontier of the interface between a public health lifestyle medicine and a personalized functional medicine-based lifestyle medicine. Now, that then begs a question, doesn't it, once we open that door? It begs the question, how much does one need then to define the uniqueness of the individual to deliver a personalized lifestyle medicine intervention program? You need to dig all the way down into doing a whole genome scan. Now I see that recently we've now gotten finally to the $1,000 genome, which had been predicted for some time. The company 23andMe has just recently offered the $1,000 genome so that one can have the whole of their genetic code deciphered for $1,000. So from that, one can map against all sorts of genetic variants and single nucleotide polymorphisms, and it's almost too much information. It's information that is greater than our ability to really analyze it today. But in the future, that genetic code will not change, but the information that we use to interpret it will be extraordinarily more sophisticated and advanced. So would we learn more and more over time about how to interpret these unique characteristics of our genomic structure? And then add to that, of course, this epigenetic evolution of understanding that's occurring now that we've spoken to considerably in Functional Medicine Update, which is what happens through experience. It puts marks on our genome that causes certain things to be more readily available for transcription, i.e. messages that say read here, and other silencing of genes saying, no, this is X-rated, you can't read this message. Those epigenetic marks, which get laid on top of our genome, so-called epigenomic message, then creates an outcome into our phenotype, into the individuals, how they look, act, and feel, that is related to how their genes are interacting with their environment in unique ways to signal these processes, these real intimate relationships of personalization. So clearly this can become more and more layered on of sophistication to where we get down to where we say, I'm so confused, I don't even know what to do with all this information. So there's some balance between the public health message and then going way down into the grit of, I'm going to do an epigenomic evaluation, I'm going to know the epigenomic code, I'm going to know the genomic code, I'm going to know metabolomics, I'm going to know proteomics. The answer is somewhere in between those two extremes, which I've just painted, is the present state of comfort where personalized lifestyle medicine can be applied from a functional medicine perspective. And I think that this panel did really an excellent job in helping us to understand where some of those boundary levels and boundary layers exist between that which we want to know and that which we do know today that can be applied with some degree of confidence in the clinic. And so when we start asking what are the validated biomarkers upon which we would build an evaluation of a patient's uniqueness, you know, we think of biomarkers or clinical biochemistry as being analytes that we used historically for defining disease, like liver enzymes, OTs, and PTs, that we would use for determining liver pathology, or we would use various kinds of markers like CPK for vascular or a cardiovascular injury, or we might use glucose, obviously, for diagnosing diabetes, or kidney problems with total protein and BUN levels. So these would be pathologically focused biomarkers that would be principally focus on driving to an ICD-9 for a diagnosis of a disease. But then we started to add to these biomarkers more functional indicators of relative risk to disease, the first one being obviously cholesterol. And if you think about it, cholesterol in our blood screen really is not there as a diagnosis for any disease. It's a prognostic marker for relative risk to disease. And then we get into the lipoprotein fractionations into particle count and into LDL, HDL, VLDL, and APO lipoproteins that are the carriers like APOA1 and APOB100, how these relate to atherogenic risk. So we get more and more differentiation into putative biomarkers that track against the relative risk to specific diseases that are a result of the mix of that person's genes with their environment. Their outcome then is seen in that array of biomarkers. We think of, for instance, elevated triglycerides and a low HDL as a biomarker that is associated with insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia, and metabolic syndrome. If the triglycerides are elevated and the HDL is low, so our ratio of triglycerides to HDL is above, say, 6 to 1, that we get increasing relative risk to type 2 diabetes, increasing insulin resistance. That's a biomarker that's associated with personalized individual risk at a functional level to a disorder. So that individual may be lean. They may not necessarily be obese. We would often say, however, those are people we would normally associate with elevated waist-to-hip ratios, but we would see in a personalized assessment there are people who actually have low BMIs that have elevated triglyceride-HDL ratios and need personalization of their program, not putting them on a weight loss program, but on an insulin management program to improve insulin sensitivity. And so that would be an example of personalized functional lifestyle medicine intervention as contrasted to a public health model. So I think that these are very interesting takeaways from this extraordinary roundtable discussion among these experts and opinion leaders. So if I was to summarize into the close of this session of our two-part series on this lifestyle medicine roundtable, it would be a message that's a little different than the message we've been transmitting for 30 years in Functional Medicine Update, in that the message would focus on the encounter, the remarkable nature of importance of the relationship between the provider and the patient in that moment of discussion about lifestyle. What you could hear from our experts on this panel was the deep, sentient, human connection that they would bring to that discussion with their patients, the nature of being good listeners, active listeners, the nature of being empathetic, the nature of asking the right questions, because without the right questions, you can't get the right answers, the nature of establishing the context of healing in that it enlists the patient in their own recovery process. That came across so loud and clear as you listen to the voice print and the languaging and the intentionality of this group of experts. It's that which I hope that we'll be able to talk about more in the context of the personalized functional medicine approach to lifestyle medicine in our second of these two-part series. But I hope you'll take away from this first version, this very powerful affirmation of the nature of the exciting opportunity that there is in developing a personalized lifestyle medicine component of practice that connects with patients in this very high-level way that gets them as part of the team, part of their own team, in fact, the captain of their team, the captain of their personalized lifestyle medicine approach. Thanks very much. We'll look forward to continuing this discussion with a little more news to use in our session 2 from our lifestyle medicine discussion.